Good morning, everyone. I think we'll get started today. Representative Chairman Davin will be here in a while. So we do not have a quorum, so we will just begin a discussion of Representative Gardner's House File 3755. And then when we reach the quorum, we will formally introduce you to
Very good.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. To the start of a busy week, I think. Mr. Chair, this will be pretty quick. I have a solid waste bill that's going through another pathway. And one of the things I'm trying to do to help meet our climate change goals this year is to promote more recycling and composting leading up to the year 2020. And one of the things that we've seen happen in the Twin Cities metro area as well as Duluth and Hutchinson is the increased collection of what's called source-separated organic materials or food waste as well as yard waste and compostable paper, which is often not recyclable. So the city of Wayzata, for example, has done curbside collection. And Representative Burns can vouch for how easy it is. I'm just trying to curry favor with the Republicans with that said. Comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative, I also represent part of Wayzata, so you can curry favor with me as well.
Oh, very good. Mm-hmm. Well, I do that on a regular basis anyway, Mr. Chair. In any case, one issue that...
when you represent North Ocean.
There's a tough question here. Mr. Chair, the purpose of this bill is really to have some truth in labeling when it comes to the bags in which this material goes. There are manufacturers which make compostable bags. They don't look all that much different, but they're often more translucent. And the idea here is that you don't have the problem that you get with this, which is compost, which has got all sorts of... I know all the telecom people here are really fascinated here by this. It's avoid having polyethylene film in there, which leads to lower value of the finished compost. And so you get something like this, which is nice, clean, non-stinky compost. And this actually has higher value, and the private sector is getting more and more involved in source-separated compost that has all sorts of applications in soil erosion control. Believe it or not, it actually works better than the sod and silt fence at reducing erosion and also landscaping applications. But in any case, people are selling bags that say they are biodegradable or compostable or degradable when in fact they are not. And so this effort is to make sure that we have manufacturers who are selling those bags follow the ASTM standard specification for compostable plastic. I'm sure that's something you can throw around the water cooler later today on the floor. But, Mr. Chair, since I don't want to turn into the plastic bag police, and because time is short and it seems a little bit excessive, I would like, if you have a quorum, to move an oral amendment to take the penalties out. But I don't know if you can.
We do at this point, yes.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I guess someone would need to move the bill, and then I can do the oral amendment. Would that be it? And Representative Scalzi, my good friend, would.
I would move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We now have a quorum. So, Representative Scalzi moves House File 3755 to be recommended to be passed and re-referred to Committee on Commerce and Labor. And then you have an amendment.
If Mr. Chair, if Representative Scalzi would be so kind to move to delete on page 1, lines 15 through 21, to delete subdivision 2, and to amend the title and correct internal references, since we've got other subdivision references in there.
I would use that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And council has all this down, so.
Any discussion? Any questions? Do we have that clarified? But would you, one of you, would you mind reading that, please, for the
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment would be on lines 15 through 21 to delete subdivision 2, line 8 would be subdivision 1, and then the title would be amended and the internal weapon would be corrected. So the bill would only have a sole business section.
Is that in the manner you would prefer?
You bet.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 All right.
And that's it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any questions from the committee? I have one. After we finish with this one, would you see if you can do about all the throwaway materials we have in the transportation lunch area and also the cafeteria in the Capitol?
Mr. Chair, the plant management division of the Department of Administration has a really good record with recycling in general, better than most office situations, and the issue of separating out food waste and either sending that to a food to hogs operation in North Metro or a compost site has come up, but we actually need more economies of scale in the St. Paul area, and the recycling contractor for the city of St. Paul is looking at doing that, and it would be an easy tuck in to do that, but probably not this year.
Any discussion from the committee?
Yeah. Thank you. I just want to go on the record of thanking Representative Gardner for not only this bill but all of his great work on solid waste. And I have a question related to it. I know that Senator Anderson has, I believe, a bill to ban plastic bags and altogether, I think. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that and especially how it may relate to this bill.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, actually I believe Representative Lesh and Senator Anderson have a bill that would require the recycling of plastic bags statewide. That's currently happening in the metro area, and the person who succeeded me at the job that I had in recycling it actually is the person who set that up with the grocers through the private sector with a little bit of capital investment from the state. And I think the issue now hinges on how easy it is to do all the collection and backhauling from grocers and other retailers in greater Minnesota. And I have not been part of those discussions, but the markets are there. The plastic decking industry uses plastic bags, polyethylene bags, all the time. So it's actually a resource that could be used. I'm all for using reusable bags. I have those when I go grocery shopping, too, and those have become more popular. I would say with policy deadlines on Friday, the idea of banning plastic bags would be a difficult venture, and China has actually just done that, and several of their plastics plants shut down as a result, so there's lots of interactions there, but this is an excellent step to focus on at least the metro and perhaps greater Minnesota to do recycling. St. Cloud and Duluth are actually about to join that program, too.
Mr. Chair, quick follow-up. So, if their bill is recycling, would it prohibit then the composting piece that your bill addresses, or how does that relate? Because sometimes it's unclear.
Well, certainly, Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein. In fact, this bill just merely says that if you sell a bag that says compostable, it really has to be compostable according to an ASTM standard.
Right. Well, hopefully, I think it's a great bill, and hopefully it could be moot if everything ends up getting recycled anyway. So.
I'm with you, Representative Bernstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to tell you how far ahead of my time I was. About 8 years ago, we started collecting grocery bags and other plastics, and it's amazing what people's creativity put in that big barrel we had.
Dead animals and all sorts of other things, I'm sure.
Worms and everything. Yeah. But we did bale that, and we did sell it. We had to save a long time to get enough for a bale because they smashed down quite a bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, it's all about truckload quantities and backhauling. But I just want to point out that people can still use plastic bags for garbage bags and other things, but when this material ends up in a compost site, it ends up mucking up the work. But I don't care so much about bags ending up in landfills because their value is essentially lost at that point. So from a recycling and composting standpoint. So.
President Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, I have a question. Representative Gardner, perhaps we can have a conversation afterwards. Since I can't talk right now.
Hopefully,
But I do have some questions. Here on, we could discuss about the strength of this, because my husband has done some research on this with some of the different big companies like Target and retailers, and that he was going at it about why they're using ethanol plastic in their bags, and some of their arguments was ethanol bags. Strong enough, so I'd be curious to know what products you have, what kind of
things. And Chair Representative Anderson, we can certainly talk on the floor, but there actually is a company in Cambridge, Minnesota, which makes compostable bags that actually is part plant-based and part petroleum-based. I mean, you can still have a petroleum-based bag that breaks down, and they're actually stronger than the original potato starch bags, which were kind of weak, so if you know, we could have our kids in the bags and hold them up and see if they break. I love
that. Any other questions from the committee? Is there anyone here who would like to speak for or against this bill? Gardner, do you have anything left to say, or we will move?
Just wish you well today and later this week with a rough week for policy deadlines. So thank you very much for your attention.
Representative moves that House File 3755 as amended be recommended to be passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, everyone. It's Representative Gunther. I believe you're up next. I'll file 3224.
Yep.
Okay. And my understanding is there's an amendment on this stuff?
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, there is an amendment. There's an amendment for low pressure boilers. This is basically for the resort industry and so forth, and any members need explanation about that, we'd be glad to have John Rakowski come up and tell us about it, because he's had a, the Senate's amendment, this amendment already, and to make this bill the way the Senate is, I thought it was very appropriate to have him on here.
All right. Any questions? Representative Gunther moves the AOH 1265 amendment. Any questions for the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Gunther, the bill is amended, sir.
Like historical boilers. Okay. This bill came to us at a workforce center in Mankato, Minnesota, and they pointed out very clearly with a little research that we were short of chief boiler engineers. And they are very necessary to have food processing plants, ethanol plants in schools and various places that have high pressure boilers. We have a 124-year-old law that has proven to be a law that makes workers very safe. So we chose not to change the law. We chose to amend it a little bit, allowing first and second class boilermen to function as a chief as long as they're working to get that grade in the future, in the very near future. And there was a committee that was made up of instructors for boiler engineers, business owners, boiler unions, and various people that were very knowledgeable about boilers. And the results came with this bill, and I think this will take care of the problem of lack of chief boiler engineers into the future, as well as not watering down the occupation at the same time. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have our chief boiler inspector for the state labor and industry, Joe Amato, give his spin on this bill.
Mr. Amato?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is Joel Amato. I'm the chief boiler inspector for the state of Minnesota. The basic overview of this bill is, like Mr. Representative Gunther said, that there was a shortage of engineers in the state because of the many industries that came into the state of Minnesota within the last couple of years. And because of the time requirement for someone to achieve a first-class license, which is 3 years, they couldn't produce those licensed engineers immediately with the need for these industries. So what we've done is we've created a provisional license, which would allow second-class or lower-class engineers to be basically operate as a first-class engineer, provided the company has an internal training program and examination process for that individual, and they state under oath that this individual is competent to take charge of that shift. Now, this provisional license would only be valuable at that facility for that person. So in other words, they couldn't take this provisional license and move to another plant unless they applied for another one. What this will do is allow for that company to provide, to stay in compliance with the law by having properly licensed engineers operating boilers, and allow them to not have to, wait for 3 year period to get those first class licensed engineers. There's also some provisions built into this law that each provisional license must be approved by the department, and they can have no more provisional license at a location than they do have properly licensed engineers. I believe that will take a lot of the burden off many of these locations for creating those licensed engineers.
Mr. Amato, so if I understand it, I'm working at a facility, I have a provisional license. Over that time, I'm working towards my regular license, and at that point, I can use that regular license anywhere. So that facilitates my process towards full licensure.
That is correct.
Other questions, Mr. Amato? Representative Quayle.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Lane just pointed this out to me. I imagine she was about ready to speak to it, but it's kind of startling to me. In Subdivision 3, line 1-8, it changes the age requirement from 18 to 16. What is the rationale for that, please?
Mr. Mann.
Mr. Chairman, the rationale behind this is because the tech colleges that are training boiler operators and licensed engineers and building facilities technicians, when you have people coming from high schools to go to these colleges, I realize this is kind of hard to explain, but you have to have a license in Minnesota before you can operate a boiler. You can't get operating experience until you have the license. So in other words, if you were coming from a high school and you were less than 18 years of age and you were at this technical college or going through this course, you couldn't get the operating experience that everybody else was getting because they were older than 18. So what we've done is allowed people that are 16 to get the special engineer's license, and that's the only license they can get is a special engineer's license at 16, and start gaining that time to get the higher class licenses if they are going to a tech college.
Representative Quayle.
So how technical is this position?
Representative Blair, I'm not sure that they have to operate under a first-class white boiler, so they have people watching them and training them the whole time.
Mr. Chair,
so
Representative Dunter, this is a totally supervised position. This young person would not be left on his or her own to be doing this function. Is that correct?
That's
my understanding.
Representative Dunter or Mr. Amato, is that made clear here in the language that the 16-year-old only applies to students in college training programs, something of the sort. I feel Representative Swell's concern.
Mr. Chair, I only state this because in my other life I teach 16-year-olds, and I'm very aware of their capabilities and sometimes their distractions.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add, the special engineer license is only valid for being in charge of boilers from 0 to, at this time, 30 horsepower, which means your smaller apartment building boilers, very small laundry and dry cleaning facilities, anything above that, they are required to be under direct supervision. The 16-year-old that does apply for this license still is required to pass an exam, which is going to be a lot more involved than the current exam process. So they still have to pass an exam in order to get this license. And I believe that the only people that are going to be able to pass this examination are ones that are attending these technical colleges and getting that experience through technical training.
Mr. Chair, I echo the chair's question, and that is the lack of specificity in the bill saying that specific thing. I would like to see an amendment that would state that.
Is that something you're wanting to work on today, or something you want to discuss with the author as the bill moves forward?
Perhaps discuss with the author as it moves forward.
If you can, a couple words. Well, actually, I'm thinking if that is the case, what we may do is that rather than changing the complete licensing,
Ms. Newman has observed that on page 5, line 18, it does say under the direct supervision of the properly licensed engineer. I don't know if that buys Representative Wells the margin of comfort she's looking for, or again, if we want to continue this discussion as the bill moves forward.
Mr. Chair, if you feel that that is clear, I do think that what the author has said, that it's for students enrolled in technical college and training for this kind of role, I would feel more comfortable personally if that language were there. When it first says 16 years old, enrolled in technical college, whatever the language would be, that means this requirement.
Representative Gunther seems to be nodding from the sense that language of that
would be very acceptable for me.
If you can words, Mr. Morgan, I'd appreciate that. Mr. Morgan, is adding language of that like going to...
Is that too restricted?
Is that going to cause problems for these students learning this type?
No, I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman. In fact, I think that addresses the problem directly. That I think that if you put in there that if you were minimum 16 years of age and enrolled in a technical college to go into this industry, that would be acceptable. Otherwise, you would have to be 18.
Okay, very good.
That would be acceptable.
We appreciate that.
Mr. Chair and members, I would suggest on page 5, line 14, after 16 years of age, to add enrolled in an accredited course at a private or public post-secondary institution. And that's slightly different than enrolled in the institution, it's enrolled in the course.
Mm-hmm. To get more specific to the trade.
Well, Mr. Chair, and members, in the instance where a 16-year-old would still be in high school and not be actually enrolled in an institution, but with a education, of course.
Representative Quill, does that meet your need?
Yes, as long as it meets Representative Gunther's needs. I don't want... Okay.
Laura, with that... Excellent. With that, Representative Swales moves that verbal amendment. Does anyone need it repeated? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, all. Representative Lane, I believe you had a question.
Well, it was the same thing, except now I'm looking at the amendment and trying to figure out where it fits. The section 1, subdivision 3, where it says 16 years, it seems to be in another part of the bill than the one we just corrected it. I'm just comparing it where that one fits.
Ms. Lane, Representative Lane, I'm sorry, I'm not quite following you.
The amendment.
All right, excellent catch. It's in the amendment, and that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're fighting with here. There seems to be a boiler deficit disorder here.
Mr. Chairman,
if
I may address this amendment.
We would appreciate that.
This amendment was brought to me by the Minnesota Steam Engineers Association, which is a group of about 150 historical boiler owners and operators. What they requested is that they change the minimum age to 16 years of age for the operation of historical boilers, for steam farm and traction engines, because they have many of these owners have children that they want to get involved in them. And they believe that by changing this to 16, that they could get their children involved and work them up to operating these historical boilers.
So, Mr. Amato, one observation for us from the city would be this is a different thing.
This is completely different from, well, from the standard licensing engineer. This is a completely different license. This is a historical boilers license that is issued by the department. And it's a one-time issuing license. You don't move up in this license. This is just a license to allow you to operate historical steam farm traction engines.
Representative Lynn, did that respond to your concerns?
Fine.
Sometimes the legislature is dangerous. Questions to the bill as amended. Representative Peterson.
I'm going to encourage this bill. I wish this had been in place before I walked into the boiler Saturday.
Nicely put. Seeing no other discussion, Representative Gunther, any final statement?
Mr. Chairman, this is
It goes to the Commerce Committee. All right. With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion that House File 3224 has amended the recommended path and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion failed. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Atkins, he is not. Maybe he's doing it. Okay. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we'll jump on to House File 635, Representative Mason. Members, this is, Representative Mason comes to the table, let's look at the minutes. Representative Scalzi, have you reviewed the minutes from...
I would recommend this
ask for it. Any discussion? All those in favor of approving the March 7th minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you. Members, this is largely a cursory hearing? Something? Thank you. Cursory hearing, as this bill has passed our committee last year, made some travels around and has returned. This is just to keep it moving on its process this year. It is Representative Mason unchanged from
okay, last year. I do have a delete all amendment for this.
Do we have a delete all amendment in our possession?
Is it 12-9? What?
$12.99.
Yes.
$12.99. Okay. There we go. With that, Representative Mason moves the $12.99 amendment. Am I correct?
Yes.
Thank you very much. The AOA 1299 amendment, I delete all amendments to be before the committee. Representative Mason, can you briefly walk us through your amendment, please?
What I
the reason that we're looking at this, as the chair has said, is that the industry raised some new concerns in the interim. We've been meeting with them. We're trying to address and the major concerns regard business-to-business contracts, prepaid phones, coverage maps, and third-party billing. And we're looking at a bill that's between the industry concerns and the need for consumer protection. As you know, we have this bill in the House, and then Senator Klobuchar has a similar bill at the national level. The bill provides basic consumer protection for clear disclosure and documentation on the contract, on contract extensions, copy of the contract and terms and conditions at purchase, coverage map showing where service is available at purchase, and clear billing and third-party billing dispute processes. And if you have questions, I'm here, and I'll try Karen Olson from the AG's office to address those.
To the amendment, any questions on the delete all amendments? Seeing none, all those in favor to delete all amendments, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. To the bill as amended.
Okay. I would like the bill next needs to be moved to 2635, and I'm here to take questions if you have any specific questions.
Ms. Olson, do you have anything that you wish to ask? Any questions for the bill? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mason, or Representative from the Attorney General's office. What are the top two or three companies that get the most complaints in Minnesota that would be impacted?
You know, under the Data Practices Act, the actual complaints and against the companies is private data. So I wouldn't feel comfortable naming with two companies because I don't think likewise they probably want to be named.
Okay.
President Hartson.
But then, Mr. Chair, under this bill, would we be able to have access to that information then, or is this just between the consumer and the company?
I'm sorry, Chairman, Representative. This really is consumer protection. Also, I guess I'm supposed to state my name, Karen Olson, Deputy Attorney General.
My apologies.
This is really consumer protections. It's disclosures. It's not calculation of consumer complaints. It's more some basic disclosures that the company would be providing the consumer, and it's based upon concerns that were also, I believe, addressed in the House last session and continue to be concerned both within the state and nationwide.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, record time. The chair renews his motion that House File 635 has amended the recommended path and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mayor. Representative Hornstein. If we can move on to House File 1224. Representative Atkins is currently tied down in the committee, which is why we're jumping around on the agenda a bit.
Mr. Chair, I have some treats this Monday. It's a long week, so let me get started on the right
side. We will be moving our committee hearings to Mondays in the future, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and I would like to move House File 1224. Mr. Chair, this was actually referred to last year to the Committee on Commerce and Labor, where we had a hearing, and then I see that it had a second reading, so I don't know if we want to go right to the floor, or what's your preference?
It needs to go back to Commerce.
Okay.
So, Representative Hornstein moves that House File 1224 be recommended to pass, and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Again, members, my name is Representative Hornstein. This is another perfunctory hearing. The bill is, as I understand it, unchanged from when we heard it last year.
Right.
And this is just, it was returned to us, and this is our process to keep it moving. Keep it alive this year. Representative Hornstein, to House File 1224.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, with that, I think you have the operative word, unchanged. And I think, unfortunately, some of the issues that this bill is trying to address also remain unchanged. And this is really in reaction to a specific union organizing effort that took place in my district at the Walker Methodist senior care facility. And I guess we have a worker from that facility here who I think much better than me can explain what went on there and why there's a need for this bill.
So. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and then proceed with your testimony.
Rosalyn Byers. Thank you.
Byers, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I said, I'm Rosalyn Byers, an LPN at Walker Methodist Health Center in Minneapolis. I'm here today to tell you a story and urge you to pass House File 1224. It will protect the rights of nursing home workers like myself. In May 2003, the workers at Walker Methodist Health Center voted 61% to 39% to join AFSCME. Management filed numerous appeals, which were all denied. Walker finally recognized AFSCME Council 5 as the exclusive bargaining representative of the employees on April 24, 2007. In July 17, 2007, the first bargaining session was held to negotiate our first contract. It's been over 8 months now of bargaining, and the employer has engaged in bad faith bargaining. For some examples, counseling bargaining dates, not signing off on tentative agreements, not putting proposals in writing, and also implementing changes without negotiating with the union. As seen by raising our health insurance premiums as of January 1, 2008. Currently, we are in mediation,
yeah.
And we have also filed unfair labor practice charges regarding bad faith bargaining with the NLRB. It is clear to the negotiating team and the members of Local 3532 that management is not willing to negotiate our first contract and attempting to bust the union. This bill would prevent Walker Methodist Healthcare Center from using tax dollars to engage in union busting efforts and suppressing the will of the employees from joining the union. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Byers. Question for either the author or the witness? I understand Mr. Leto is here in the room?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there you are. That's good. Mr. Leto, you were wanting to testify. Don't need to.
1 minute.
That we'll start the clock now.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brad Leto, Chief of Staff of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And yes, this bill was passed through two committees last year. I just wanted the other things that I wanted to say is I think the bill is even more needed this year to protect taxpayers' money, especially when we're in budget deficit, and also when we have the jobs bill, Job Z bill, going through the process to make sure that taxpayer dollars are accounted for even better. So bigger reporting requirements for Job Z. It seems only fair that we should have some basic protections for taxpayer dollars in this case. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Leto. Representative Peterson.
I had a question for the acting for the author.
We can bring him back.
I want to thank you for the goodies. And I want you to know I'm no pushover, but I can be had. So.
Representative Peterson is so far the goodies the best part of the weekend.
Well, I've been getting a lot of goodies this weekend.
Oh, good.
What is the pushback you have heard? You've had carried this bill for a couple of years. What is the resistance you hear to this bill?
Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, surprisingly, beyond the particular facility in question that I mentioned in my district, I've not heard a lot of organized opposition to it. Perhaps there'll be someone today that surfaces, but we haven't really had specific concerns since it was introduced. I think the chamber actually does, and they will probably be here as well. But beyond that, I haven't had a lot of pushback, as you say.
There was, Representative Peterson, there was testimony last year in opposition from the chamber, and they are here to testify against the bill.
Okay.
Other questions for the author? Mr. Dietrich, welcome back. And Ms. Beyer, thank you for coming today. Mr. Dietrich, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrich with the Minnesota Chamber, and again, I will be very brief since we did testify against this bill last year. Simply stated, the Chamber believes that the areas of law covered in this piece of legislation are covered by federal law that applies to our employers. And currently, there is almost identical language from this bill that is before the United States Supreme Court right now. It's waiting for deliberation. It's a case in from law in California, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of similar type legislation. The Second and Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals have ruled in different directions, and so right now the issue is being resolved before the United States Supreme Court, and we would like to see some resolution, not only federally, before any action taken at the state level, but we also believe that this is an issue of federal law for our members. With that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Any questions for the testifier? Any questions to the bill? Representative Anderson. I would suggest email in your case.
I might have to do that. Reference, Mr. Chair, Reference Hornstein. Will this have any impact on us as legislators? Say, for example, the state union were to strike, and we were to cross the picket lines, would that be something that are appropriate? Would we be considered the employer in this case? How would that impact us as a legislature?
Representative Hornstein. Mr. Chair, I'll call up Mr. Leto from the AFL-CIO to comment on that.
Mr. Leto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I understand your question, if the state employees would strike, that's the question. Okay. If they have a different area of law, if they have a union that's already represented, they've been represented in their contract negotiations, it's a different area, I believe in this case, that I don't think it would affect that situation, that's what it's saying.
I have a more question.
With that, seeing no further questions, the Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 1224 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Members in the audience at this time, Representative Atkins is the last bill on our agenda to be heard today. He is delayed. We will recess to the call of the chair approximately 5 minutes. Perhaps three. We'll see. Okay. I assume there's no.
Some of the advantages of being self-insured.
I'm going to go to the next one.
Yes, the committee can come back to order, please. Representative Atkins, welcome. House File 3365. The chair will move House File 3365 to be before the committee recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your patience. I come bearing good news. I just met with my accountant this morning and found out that you don't need to worry about the state budget. I apparently am going to fully fund that myself.
It's been a great year in the legal field.
I guess so, Mr. Chair. I just wish the full committee could evaporate as efficiently as this one. I understand you guys made quick work of your earlier bill. So this House file, very briefly, there was an experiment that took place with respect to baseball arbitration as it applies to firefighters. Baseball arbitration, and there's a more formal name for it, but you all know what it is. It says both sides come in, one offer, the other offer, and the arbitrator has to pick one or the other. It works great if you're dealing with small groups, like a school board or city council or something like that. When it comes to a huge group of firefighters, it's a little different than dealing with a single baseball player. If I go to Johan Santana and I say, Johan, your offer's your demand is too high, we've got the likelihood of the arbitrator picking your demand is very, very slim because you're asking for too much. It's easy to make one person or cause one person to bring that back into some sort of reality basis. It's harder with a large group, folks, and I'm glad the firefighters tried this approach, but it's very, very difficult when you're talking about dealing with hundreds of people to get them to a point where they make a sort of demand or present an offer for an arbitrator that it's likely that they will accept. So this has gone the wrong way. I'd appreciate your support. I do have Brian Rice here, who will offer some testimony as well.
Mr. Rice, good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Rice. I'm the attorney for the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. It's a group that represents approximately 2,000 full-time paid firefighters in the state and about 40 locals in the state of Minnesota. Representative Atkins was correct about the fire law. There, in 1999, the legislature passed an experiment that allowed firefighters to be treated differently than all other essential employees. And instead of using conventional arbitration to resolve wage disputes and contract negotiation matters, they carved out and said they would use final offer, total package final offer arbitration, which Representative Atkins correctly described as baseball. It's each the employer and the union each submit an offer. The employer then has no choice. He either takes the union position or the employer position on all issues, and that settles that's the result of the contract. So I guess in the context of politics, it's the winner-take-all system. You either win it all or you lose it all. Conventional arbitration, which applies to all other essential employees, is you submit your final positions item by item, and the arbitrator has the choice of picking some from one list, some from the other list, or reaching a compromise in between any of the offers that are made. I think the experience in the state under PELRA, that's how in 1971 when PELRA was passed, it's the conventional arbitration method, and it's one that's worked for all the other essential employees, and we feel has worked well for firefighters as well. The leadership of the Professional Firefighters Association voted last year to seek this repeal. Representative Atkins was kind enough to introduce it. We do have a number of not only several large groups, as Representative Atkins pointed out, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth have found it a challenge, but several of our smaller locals have found it to be a challenge too. East Grand Forks is a good example. About 2 years ago, they went to arbitration. These are not big locals. Some of them only have, a dozen members. They wrote their positions, but they included part of the BMS process is you have you reach an impasse, the BMS gives you 14 days to submit your final positions. Once those final positions are submitted to the BMS, they're forwarded to the arbitrator. The local wrote up their offer, and they included a provision that would have done something illegal. It was a minor point, but they asked for like a schedule change or something. They weren't aware of it. Their final offer was submitted. The arbitrator, in a letter to the local, said, I would have taken your position, but by law I can't. An arbitrator doesn't have the authority to impose an illegal term on an employer, and said, you wrote a bad offer, basically, or a bad final position, and you rejected the union's position and awarded the employer's position. Just last December, we had another small outstate local that had a bad experience on the thing, and there is that element. I think as they've moved ahead, several of the unions have found that it has not been good. I think you will be hearing from the League of Cities that they have liked the experiment, and so maybe to some degree you're going to say, well, we're just coming here and crying. That's a part of it, but I think fundamentally we don't think it's a good way to resolve disputes. Lastly, I'd really put it in the context of legislating. If you as legislators were given one choice, the bill or not the bill, or the bill or the first alternative, it doesn't make for a good process in resolving disputes over in the legislature, nor do we feel it doesn't make a good process for resolving collective bargaining disputes at the bargaining table.
Any questions from the testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to test? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative
Gunther. Offer practice that you have in place, they couldn't make an amendment to eliminate an illegal portion of that? It's just the whole thing or nothing?
You're correct.
Then, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, at the point you collectively bargain, and obviously it's a bargaining table. If people can reach an agreement, they do, but there are certain constraints. I mean, there's some things in law that are impermissible subjects of bargaining. What happens is that you go to bargain, and for essential employees, it's required before you go to arbitration, you invite in the Bureau Mediation Service, and they mediate the dispute. If at the end of the mediation period the parties still are unresolved, the Bureau of Mediation tells both parties, submit your final, you have 14 days to write up submit your final positions on the items at impasse. The two groups will then formally write the letter, and by such and such a date, as Representative Atkins says, by April 17th, he's got to file his taxes. Each party then gets a date. You submit your positions, but once those positions are submitted to the BMS, they can't be changed. I mean, those are your final positions. They can't be altered, and then you go in front of the mediator, and whatever is there then in baseball arbitration, the arbitrator picks one or the other. He can't fashion a compromise. And in East Grand Forks, the local union wrote a final offer that had a term that was illegal. I mean, it was contrary. It was an impermissible subject of bargaining. They're not, in some cases, it's a sophisticated process. I've done collective bargaining for over 20 years, and I've had some cases that you really have to be extremely diligent in what you put in that final offer. And even, I had a dispute one time with the state. It wasn't. But the other side can say, wait a minute, you're trenching into an area that's impermissible subject to bargaining, in which case you can affect your whole final position. So it takes a fair degree of sophistication, and a lot of these smaller locals really rely on their members and knowledge to handle it, and sometimes you can mess up.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 3365?
Sure, if I might, this is my friend. The cities are coming to the table. The one thing I failed to point out that is extremely important is that if a city and its firefighters still want to use baseball arbitration, they still can't. All this bill says is that they don't have to. Okay, right now they have to. So if it's working well in a particular city, they still have that absolute option, and they can present it to the arbitrator as an either or. This just says you also have the rest of the gamut if it works for a particular city and firefighters. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Laura Kushner, and I'm the Human Resources Director for the League of Minnesota Cities. Part of my role at the League is to advise cities on employment and labor relations issues, and that's why I'm here testifying today. I need to state on record the League's opposition to this House File 3365, which repeals the default option of final offer total package arbitration for firefighters. What we are hearing from our cities is that this is a good way to avoid disputes over labor negotiations. Basically, when the law was changed several years ago, we weren't too sure. It was an experiment, that's correct. We didn't know if we'd like it. But cities do like it. We're finding that it works, that it works on both sides, that both the city is forced to bargain and bargain hard to come up with a reasonable package that the arbitrator will like, and that the firefighters are forced to do the same. So what we're also hearing from cities, and I apologize, I don't have any numbers for you, but we're hearing that arbitrations are down. So it's actually avoiding disputes, and it's working very well for us. Basically, that's really all I have to say, is that it's working for us, and we'd like to keep it as the default. It is correct that cities will still have the option to do that, but it will have to be with the agreement of both the union and the employer in order to, if this is repealed today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kushner. Questions for the test clerk? Questions for the author?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the League of Cities, yeah, would it be possible for you to get some of those statistics for us about the number of mediations and final agreements and how fast they're getting done in the, since this has been in effect? You said you didn't have any of the numbers with you. I think that I would really appreciate those.
Mr. Chair, yes, I don't know that we could. We can approach BMS, Bureau of Mediation Services, to see if they have any statistics about arbitrations prior to this becoming law and after, if that would be helpful.
Is it
good? Yes, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Representative. Representative Atkins, last word.
Appreciate the support.
With that, the chair removes his motion that House File 3365 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, ladies and gentlemen, this is our last formal meeting before deadlines. I want to thank everyone for their participation this year, and particularly thank the staff for all the efforts and supporting work that they've done to make the committee operate. Thank you. With that, we stand adjourned.